Okay, the first thing is, for those of you who missed class on Friday, I'm going to be giving back the rest of the midterms today at the end of the class. But before you speak with me or with Matt about the, if you have any questions about it, be sure you do what I asked people to do last time. I'm sure those of you who missed class, you probably heard the Bruin cast. But let me just repeat it briefly. Before you speak to Matt, who's the reader for the course, you should do what you have to do in order to find out what the answers to the questions are. In other words, listen to the old broomcasts or do the reading until so that you make a real effort to kind of figure out the answers for yourself. Then and only then should you see Matt about any questions you have. And if you still aren't happy after you've spoken with him, then you should come and see me. But please use that procedure, okay? And for those of you who are not in class today and have missed class on Friday as well, this is the last day I'm actually going to be bringing the exams into class. And from then on, you should just come by during my office hours, which are Tuesday from 3 to 5, to pick up your exam. Don't forget about the grade concordance table, which is on the course website, and Matt's email address is there as well. Did you set office hours? Today from 1 to 3? Okay. And where? 3385 Bunch. Okay. Okay. Let me just review where we left off last time. Last time I was talking about the 1947 to 49 period. And what was the story there? The story of 1947 is that the West moves, quite reluctantly on the part of Secretary of State Marshall, toward embracing the Western strategy. In other words, for giving up on the idea that you could work things out with the Soviets and that you could reach some sort of understanding with them on the central issue, the dominant issue in great power politics, which is the German question, the question of the future of Germany. Can you run Germany as a unified entity? Will the Germans be allowed to have a government of their own? What sorts of restrictions are you going to place on Germany? All those issues were, for obvious reasons, given the history of the 20th century, and given especially what the Soviets had just gone through during the war, which is just terribly devastating for them, those issues were bound to be of absolutely fundamental political importance. I explained to you why they had to lie at the heart of the Cold War. Of course, the German question is the one great exception to the general rule about how the two sides could live with each other in the post-war period. The general rule is each side has a free hand in its part of Europe, its side of the line of demarcation. On that basis, the America and Russia could live with each other, right? The division of Europe is not the problem. It's not the cause of the Cold War. It's the solution to the problem of how the two sides can live with each other. They run things in the East, we and our friends run things in the West. Okay? So, you could turn it on, but I don't think it works. So I fiddled around with that stuff for about 5 minutes before Thursday. Okay? The German issue, the German question, was the one great exception to that rule. Why? Because this is the one area where the Soviets couldn't give the Western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they wanted. They didn't object to the idea that the Western powers would have the primary responsibility for setting things up in Western Germany, in the three Western zones. That was not what they had a problem with. What they had a problem with was the whole idea that Western Germany should be run not just without them, which they could accept, but against them, that Western Germany should be organized against them. Right? And yet, that was, in a sense, implicit in the Western strategy. It's the Western strategy, the whole idea of organizing the three Western zones of Germany under the aegis of the three Western powers, right? And tying West Germany to the Western world in all kinds of different ways, you know, beginning with economically, going through politically, and ending up militarily. This was not an obviously viable strategy. Why was it not a viable strategy? Because you're asking people throughout the West to accept the idea that all these hopes that had come into being during the war years about how America and Russia would be able to get along and run things in the post-war period in a relatively friendly way, you're saying, no, that's not going to work. And if those wartime hopes are disappointed, someone is going to have to be blamed for that. Yeah, someone is going to have to be held responsible. Well, Stalin. He's responsible for not, cooperating with the Western powers, opting for a more friendly policy. Okay. No, it's fine. I have. As a matter of fact, I should probably put the light on for the certain things. By the way, I did put the outline on the course website, and it's just that the computer is screwed up today, so I couldn't project it on the screen. But that's basically the outline. All right. So so you're going to disappoint a lot of people, and you have to explain to people why that happened. And it's all the fault of Stalin and of the nasty Russians and this sort of thing. And it's not just people in America or in Britain and France that you had to kind of make that kind of case to, but in a sense, even more importantly, you had to make that case to the Germans. Because the Western strategy, building up a state in Western Germany, this was tantamount to asking them to accept the division of their country. To accept the fact that half of pre-war German territory was lost, and that all these Germans who lived east of the Elbe River were basically under communist rule, which is to say, in those days, essentially under Soviet rule, under the rule of a foreign power, and no reason to love you. So how are you going to get the Germans to accept a policy which amounted to the division of their country? You know, Germans would be tempted to some sort of neutralist solution. You know, no, they didn't want to be under Soviet control, obviously, but they didn't like, a lot of them didn't like the idea of throwing their lot with the West. Well, you had to play up the Soviet threat. It's not our fault Germany's divided. We never wanted it. It's the Soviets who insisted on imposing a communist police state in East Germany. If they had their way, they'd like to take over all of Germany. If you want to preserve any degree of freedom at all, it has to be on a West-only basis. So the Western strategy implied that you're going to have to point the finger at the Soviets and tell the Germans that the Russians are their great enemies, the enemies of German national unity. And that implied also that you had to suggest to the Germans that you were basically sympathetic with their national goals, that you didn't like the idea of a divided Germany, of a divided Europe, and that you would kind of support a revisionist German policy. Well, all of this was just anathema to the Soviets. Okay? The whole notion that a very powerful state, and most of Germany's resources are located in the West, which is the most industrialized part of the country, that a strong West German state would be a danger to them. And it would be foolish for them to just sit on their hands and allow the process of a resurgent German power to develop. And so it was best to kind of nip it in the bud. So the story of 1947 is a story, especially on the part of the American Secretary of State at that time, Neil, maker of American policy, George Marshall. A kind of a reluctant embrace of the Western strategy. Finally, December 1947, at the London Conference, reaches the conclusion, we have no choice, we can't work things out with the Soviets, we're going to have to do all this stuff on a West-only basis, we're going to have to set up a West German state, we're going to have to tie that West German state into the Western world in general, into Western Europe in particular. All those ideas, European integration, meaning continental West European integration, you know, are very much coming into their own in this period. It's not surprising that this decision to embark on that policy, essentially made in December of 1947, and formalized in the London recommendations, which were issued in early June 1948, to create a West German state, to set up that process leading to a West German state, that this would lead to a Soviet reaction. So one of the key points last time was that events during that 47 to 49 period moved along these three independent but interrelated tracks. The process leading to the creation of a West German state, which climaxes in the spring of 1949 with the establishment of the Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany, as we called it. The Soviet reaction to that, later in that month of June 1948, the Berlin blockade. This is what was the point of the Berlin blockade? To take over the city of Berlin? Very clearly, no. If that was what the Soviets had wanted, they would have behaved in an entirely different manner. In particular, the one thing that was allowing the status quo in Berlin to persist, because it was only land access, ground access to Berlin that was being cut off, was the airlift, the famous Berlin airlift. But it would have been the easiest thing in the world for the Soviets to interfere with the airlift through nonviolent means. All you had to do was to jam the radars. I don't know if any of you have ever been in Northern Europe in the wintertime, but it's always overcast, because this is where the kind of the cold air of Russia kind of hits the warm, moist air of the Gulf Stream in the Atlantic, or just off the coast of Western Europe. It's always cloudy over there. And so in order for these planes to come in at the rate that he had to come in order to supply an entire city, you needed effective radars. It's very easy to jam radars. But not only did the Soviets not jam the radars, but they continued to cooperate with the West in managing air traffic in and around Berlin. There was something called the Berlin Air Safety Center, where the Soviet and Western air controllers arranged for the control of air traffic into Berlin. The Soviets aren't interested in taking over Berlin. They make it clear over and over again that that Berlin is just a lever, West Berlin, and that this is the Western powers' Achilles heel. They're putting pressure on the Western powers because they want the Western powers to take their concerns about West Germany more seriously and not to simply move ahead on a West-only basis, but to kind of work things out more with an eye to Soviet interests. Yeah. That's right, they didn't, right? So if you want to kick the Western powers out of West Berlin, you want to have a total blockade. You want to prevent any Western supplies from coming in. The airlift is what keeps West Berlin viable. But that's not the Soviet goal. The Soviet goal is much larger than Berlin. Okay? So the Berlin blockade is a response to the Western policy of setting up a West German state. But the Berlin blockade creates a certain sense that there's a risk of war in Europe. This is a real challenge to the position of the Western powers. They were in Berlin by right. There was an agreement establishing the division of the city of Berlin, Greater Berlin, into four sectors. Soviets were party to this agreement that allotted the three Western powers control over the three Western sectors of Berlin. So there's a real risk of war or it seemed like that the situation could lead to war. What if the Western powers decided to stand up for their rights, send some, an armored column into Berlin to assert their right of access there? And then what if the Soviets decided, no, they weren't going to permit that, and they tried to block it, and one thing led to another, and there was fighting and so on? Could the West risk that? Well, not in 1948 they couldn't, because the military balance, the ground military balance, heavily favored the Soviet side. The Soviets had massive superiority in the theater there. There was really nothing much in the way of forces and being that could prevent the Soviets from overrunning or all of Western Europe if they wanted to. Of course, that would just be the beginning of a Third World War, and the outcome of that Third World War would not have been the liking of the Soviets, because they would have been utterly devastated at the end of the war. It might take 5 or 10 years to run its course, but the Soviet homeland would be decimated with nuclear attacks with bombs and bombers produced after the beginning of the war. The Western powers didn't have very much in the way of forces in being at all, right? And so this notion was that the Berlin blockade dramatized the fact that the problem of the imbalance of military power in Europe had to be taken seriously. The United States, after the war, had just torn up this remarkable military establishment that had been built up during the war. It's like, by 1948, there was very little left of this enormously powerful force that had been built up during the war. There was this huge shift of American resources away from the military toward civilian activities. It's the great period of suburbanization, the post-war baby boom, all these former soldiers are coming back and starting families and all that kind of thing. The bottom line was that there was not much in the way of forces and being to kind of serve as a counterweight to Soviet military power in Europe, and that situation was not a particularly comfortable situation, not for the Americans, but especially not for the Europeans, who there was the prospect of a long Third World War, and the Soviets would probably draw back from that prospect, but if there was a Third World War, Western Europe would just be devastated in the process, not least by American atomic bombs. The Americans would have to bomb the production facilities in what were recognized to be friendly countries simply to keep them out of Soviet hands. So the sense was, we need something better than this. We need to establish the framework for an effective Western military force to balance Soviet power in Europe. So these concerns that were triggered by the Berlin blockade led to the negotiations on a Western Security Pact, and ultimately to the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty, the treaty establishing the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, a treaty that was signed in April of 1949. And it was about that same time also that the Soviets lifted the Berlin blockade, basically signaling that they had accepted the establishment of the West German state. As a matter of fact, later that year, they set up their own puppet state in East Germany, called the German Democratic Republic. For most of the early Cold War years, people in the West called it the so-called German Democratic Republic. It had less legitimacy even than the communist regimes in East Germany. Okay? So three processes interconnected. They run their course in this 48-49 period. So by the end, by the end of that period, by the spring of 1949, you would think that, things had been tested. The basic structure of the system had been tested, and now we have the rudiments of a political system that have fallen into place. The Soviets have accepted the division of Europe in a more or less formal way. We have these two German states formally set up. Right? NATO, a formal institution, set up. Formal division of Europe between East and West. By lifting the Berlin blockade, by establishing the German Democratic Republic, the Soviets have accepted the divided Europe. The Americans have accepted the division of Europe. And so the question then is, for our purposes, so what went wrong? If everyone has accepted the division of Europe, why don't you have peace? Right? And you may remember that this is the same way we analyzed the beginning of the Cold War in 1945-46. 1945, you have the Burns Plan, the Burns Strategy, the meeting of the minds between Burns and Stalin in Potsdam, a friendly division of Europe, you know, an amicable divorce. You control things in your sphere, we'll control things in ours in a kind of informal way, not public at all. As a matter of fact, the Potsdam Protocol gave exactly the opposite impression. And so we looked at that and said, well, that should have been the basis of a stable international system. And we looked at how it was extended in the arrangements that Stalin and Burns worked out in late 1945, kind of confirmed by the agreements that were reached at the Moscow Conference in December of 1945. You know, clear idea there was, well, they'll control things in Eastern Europe, we'll call the shots in Western Europe and in Japan. On that basis, we can get along. So this set the problem. What happened in 1946 that they started shouting at each other, that relations went downhill so dramatically? And the answer there had to do with these events on the USSR's southern border, the Turkish and Iranian crises of the spring of 1946, which triggered this reaction in the West, that the only thing these guys respect is force. We got to mobilize our own people. We got to mobilize our own power. We have to kind of, we can do this by, pounding the table and pointing the finger and saying how awful they were, and they respond in kind and so on. And this is kind of competition for German favor we saw in late 1946, the Burns-Stuttgart speech, and all that kind of thing, right? So that was like the whole Potsdam business in 45, the amicable divorce business. It's a false dawn, you know? And to kind of anticipate, the basic structure of this part of the course is that we're interested both in understanding what the Cold War is about and also why it was that a stable international system did take place, did take shape, ultimately, during the Cold War period, essentially from 1963 on. So, well, we can get at that by structuring it in the following way. We're going to look at three false dawns and then one true one. The false dawn of 1945, you know, Potsdam business and everything. Why did that fail? What happened in 1946? Then again, 1949, formal division of Europe between East and West, the establishment of the two German states, the establishment of NATO, the lifting of the Berlin blockade. That's a second false dawn, because if you just kind of put yourself back at that point in time, you say, well, where's the problem? Both sides, and maybe the Soviets didn't like what the Western powers were doing in West Germany, but they had accepted it. They had come to accept it. Right? And so then our question then is, so what happened? Because the following year, the world goes into this very, very deep crisis, the crisis of the winter of 1950-51. Very scary period. I think I mentioned this before. To my mind, it was like more frightening than the period of the Berlin and Cuban crises in 1961-62. What happened? And then we'll see how, following that that crisis of the winter of 50-51, when it seemed like the world really was right on the brink of the Third World War. Stalin pulls back to a certain extent, the Americans pull back, and a system is worked out among the Western powers, and between the Western powers and West Germany. You know, the system, this is the 1954 system, the system was called the Paris Accords of October of 1954. And again, as I'll explain, this was a system that could have, in theory, provided the basis for a stable international system, could have, in theory, provided the basis for a viable relationship between East and West, where there was no real risk of war. And once again, the question is, what happens? Because ultimately, you have a second great period of crisis in the beginning in November of 58 and climaxing the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 62. Right? And then finally, after that, in 1963, you have a false dawn, but this time not, I'm sorry, a fourth dawn, but this time not a false one, but a true one. The 1963 arrangements did provide the basis for a stable international order, and the threat of a Third World War receded quite dramatically after 63. Not to say the Cold War ended, but the system became much more viable, much more stable. Okay, so what happened in 1949? Right? What happened in the period from 1949 to the end of 1950? Why did these 49 arrangements not work? Should have worked. Why did they not work? The answer is, and this point I think is very important. The answer is they did not work because no true political accommodation had been made. If you want peace, you need a political understanding. Why did the Soviets pull back in the spring of 49? Not because they were happy with what the Western powers were doing in West Germany. Not because their fundamental concerns about a possible resurgence in German power and the threat that that would pose to them had suddenly gone away. Nothing had been done to put an end to that. They had pulled back simply because the military conjuncture was not favorable to them. The military conjuncture was, they would score dramatic initial victories in Europe, and they would be able to march right through to the Atlantic without any trouble, but that would just be the beginning. America couldn't do very much to the Soviets at the beginning of the war, because, that period of the late 1940s, low military budgets, there was no sense of full speed ahead and the building of atomic bombs and of preparation for war. In fact, quite the opposite. Very small number of atomic bombs. And these are just primitive atomic bombs. You know, they can devastate an area about one square mile or at least a circle with a radius of a mile, basically like UCLA and Westwood. Very much unlike the great thermonuclear explosives that would come to dominate the scene beginning in 1952, 1,000 times more powerful than those early atomic bombs. Like 40 or 50 of those things, the thermonuclear explosives, they could just destroy even the biggest countries as functions. That was not the case with these early atomic bombs. Countries could absorb thousands of these weapons and still survive. So if a war had broken out in 1948 and 1949, the United States could do no more than simply bruise the Soviets at the outset of the war. Doesn't mean that this was simply a hollow threat. As long as you had a nuclear monopoly, what happened at the beginning of the war didn't really matter much. As long as you had a nuclear monopoly, you could take your time and gear up and start building bombs and bombers, and sooner or later you could totally destroy military-industrial infrastructure and ultimately the war-making power of your adversary through a sustained campaign of air atomic bombardment. As I say, it might take, if something was in those days, it would take something like 5 or 10 years to do it, but the outcome of the war would be very, very clear. So as long as the Soviets did not have atomic bombs of their own, you could proceed in a fairly leisurely way. You didn't have to be excessively worried. You could rely on a tripwire strategy to deter the adversary. Didn't mean that you felt like you really had the upper hand either, because if war did break out, yeah, you'd win in the end, but it would be a Pyrrhic victory for you, because in the process of reconquering Europe, you would totally devastate your own allies, your own, countries like France and Western Germany would be destroyed in the process. So you didn't want to come close to war. Neither side wanted to come close to war. The two sides in military terms were in balance. That was why the Soviets weren't particularly aggressive during the Berlin blockade. Why for that matter, the Americans weren't particularly aggressive during the Berlin blockade affair. Right? This is, both sides were held back by an appreciation for these military realities. But it was a precarious balance. Because the one thing that was balancing Soviet military power in Europe was the American nuclear monopoly and the prospect of a one-sided air atomic war. And all that is broken overnight on August 29th, 1949. So it's just like one of a handful of dates in the post-war period that kind of stick in your mind. August 29th, 1949. It's a few months after you would think that the whole European business had been settled. The American nuclear monopoly is broken. This was the day in which the Soviets exploded their first nuclear device. So the one thing that had counterbalanced Soviet land power in Europe, namely the American nuclear monopoly, disappears. And what this suggests now is that the Soviets are the ones who have the upper hand. It's important to understand this. It's important to understand that if the military situation was the one thing that kept things in control in early 1949 and led the Soviets to appear to accept the status quo in Europe, the transformation of the military situation was bound to have far-reaching consequences. It was bound to lead to a more aggressive communist policy. Aggressive in, maybe not aggressive in the deep sense, but aggressive in the sense of, we have to get this German problem under control. We can't do it in a friendly way with the Western powers. We therefore have to, contemplate the use of force, and we have to base our policy on the sense that a serious conflict with them is inevitable sooner or later, and if that's the case, maybe we should have it out with them while we have something of an advantage. And why did they think they had an advantage? And it's very important to understand the military aspect of this problem. When the United States had a nuclear monopoly, they didn't have to be worried about what happened at the beginning of the war. The fact that we had very few bombs and very few planes with which to deliver these bombs, that the overseas bases weren't secure, they were vulnerable to any attack, our target intelligence was pathetic. Those were real problems. It meant that the initial atomic blow that the United States could have launched if a war broke out in the late 1940s would have had a minimal effect. You didn't have to worry because what was really important was what would happen after the outbreak of the war. The kind of damage that could be caused by bombs and bombers you produced after the outbreak of the war. And they couldn't prevent you from producing them because they had no way of devastating your homeland and destroying your own air atomic infrastructure. So you could take your time, you could remedy these problems with insecure foreign bases and inadequate target intelligence after the war broke out. you can, not terrific, but you can live with that situation. Well, overnight, all of that changed. And all these problems that didn't really matter much in the era of the American nuclear monopoly, now they mattered a great deal. Why do they matter a great deal? Because there's going to be a race. Right? If a war breaks out, each side is going to try and get the upper hand, in effect, as close to a nuclear monopoly as it can. And what that means is each side is going to have to try and destroy the aircraft production facilities, the nuclear weapons production facilities of its adversary. And you need to do that more quickly than your adversary is trying to do the same thing to you. Your adversary is going to be able to attack you. There's a myth that the United States was invulnerable to Soviet atomic attack at this time. It's quite clear that it's a myth because the Soviets had managed to make a replica of an American B-29 that landed on Soviet soil during the war. And these aircraft were perfectly capable of delivering bombs on American targets in one-way missions. The pilot, after dropping the bombs, would simply go on and land in Mexico and be interned there for the rest of the war. These one-way missions were sufficient to deliver this. The Soviets knew where all these American production facilities were. Nothing was secret in the United States. Americans sensed that our overseas bases were vulnerable. If our overseas bases were vulnerable, it would be very hard to launch an intercontinental attack. These kind of lumbering, huge B-36 intercontinental bombers, very vulnerable to... The Soviets might actually be able to destroy the American air atomic infrastructure more effectively and more quickly than we were able to do the same thing to them. And once they did that, and had achieved an effective nuclear monopoly, they can go on and destroy the entire American military industrial base and develop such a degree of military power that the United States couldn't stand up to them. So this was the great fear, right? General Bradley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says in the National Security Council in November of 1950, I have to say, I was just amazed when I read this, say, if war breaks out now, we're in danger of losing it. We might very well lose the war. And the Soviets saw things the same way. They're getting ready for a war in a very serious way. We know this, or the American government knew this, because the Soviets were briefing the East European leaders, the leaders in the satellite states in East Europe, to get ready for the war. And the Soviets were doing all these things in the material sphere that suggested that they thought a war might very well be imminent. This is in 1950, mid-1950, before the outbreak of the Korean War. And the East European regimes are far better penetrated by American intelligence than Tsar itself. So we were getting a lot of good information. Stalin actually wrote to Mao, the Chinese leader, in November of 1950, I think this was. He says to Mao, and urging the Chinese to take a tough line, standing up to the Americans over the Korean War, says, if war is inevitable, let it happen now. Quite extraordinary. And all this business about the military balance is of fundamental importance because it shows why the Soviets were now taking a far more aggressive line. And this was understood by the Americans. American leaders understood that the breaking of the American nuclear monopoly would embolden the Soviets. They didn't know exactly where it was going to come. They thought it might, could come in Iran or Turkey or Finland or Yugoslavia. There were a bunch of hot spots on the periphery of the Soviets. In the event, it came in Korea. And the Americans, for their part, in large measure because the American military authorities were so sensitive to these issues of limited U.S. military resources, American power being overextended, these low military budgets in the late 1940s were having devastating consequences, the American military leaders were constantly arguing against extending our commitments. And it was in large part for that reason that Secretary of State Atchison gave a famous speech in early 1950, putting South Korea outside the American defense perimeter. The Americans had made a decision in 1947 basically to withdraw from South Korea, abandon South Korea to its fate. All these things make sense only in the context of these military realities. So the actual act that the Americans expected, in the event it came in Korea, the North Korean attack on the South in June of 1950, not a massively aggressive, dangerous act, because the Americans had already suggested that South Korea lay outside the defense perimeter. When the Americans did get involved, you know, reversing their prior policy, the communists could practically sue us for breach of promise. But the Americans do get involved, and the North Koreans are thrown back, and the Americans, American military people there in Korea, General MacArthur, are exhilarated by this and think that they could liberate all of Korea and reunify the country, and are marching right up to the Chinese border of the Yalos. It was then that the Chinese intervened in November of 1950. This is much more serious than the original North Korean attack, because the Chinese were under no illusions that this would lead to hostilities with the Americans. And not only did the Chinese push the Americans out of North Korea, but they were threatening to throw the Americans entirely off the Korean Peninsula, the point where to save these American forces, Truman was actually considering using nuclear weapons locally in this industry. And again, all of this is in the context of the shift in the global balance of power, and Stalin's sense that maybe, you know, action in Europe will be needed as well. Right on the brink. So how do the Americans react? They make very important rearmament decisions at this time, especially at the end of 1950, December of 1950, very dark days. The American government approves a document called NSC 68/4, which calls for something like a quintupling of expenditure on for military purposes. Only a small portion of this is related to the Korean War. Most of it is targeted at the building up of American military power across the board, nuclear, conventional, what have you. Okay. But this creates a danger in its own right. This creates the danger that the Soviets will see their window of opportunity closing. Can they really wait until the Americans have built up military power? And there's going to be a huge time gap from when the decision is made in December of 1950 to when real military power in terms of forces of being and what they're capable of doing, until real military power is built up. Why is this? Because this is a period of very dramatic change in military technology. And it's not just nuclear, but it's across the board. You look at, aircraft. They're switching at this point from propeller to jet-driven aircraft. Beginnings of military computerization with the use of computers, which were developed initially for military purposes during the war, being used in the SAGE air defense system in the early 1950s. You know, this new technology, it takes a long, long time to retool the factories so that the weapons that are produced are kind of very modern weapons that embody this new technology. It's not like December of 1941 when these automobile plants in Detroit can shift overnight from producing cars and trucks to producing Jeeps and tanks. It's it takes a much longer time to retool the factories, to train people in the use of these, you know, more technologically sophisticated weapons and deploying them to the forces in the field and so on. So really, it's not until late 1952 that the military balance does shift. But when it does shift, the Americans have this huge mass of the most modern, technologically advanced weapons, while the Soviets have, you know, just a huge amount of obsolescent material. That means the Americans are headed for developing massive military superiority. Given that that's the case, the Soviets sense that their window of opportunity is closing rapidly. And this gives them yet an additional incentive to move before it's too late. This is part of the reason why you have, these serious preparations on the part of the Soviets for a war in Europe in this 50-51. Just a couple more points again. But the Americans, they understand all these kind of window dynamics. But they're undeterred from moving ahead. Meaning that the risk of war is high for that reason alone. And it's not just that. Acheson especially wants to move ahead in terms of the building up of ground power in Europe. And to create a viable defense in Western Europe, it's clear to the military authorities in all these countries, the United States, Britain, France, Acheson himself for that matter, that you're going to need German troops. That you're going to need German troops as part of the Western defense system. So this issue of German rearmament comes to the top of the agenda. And Acheson, he meets with his British and French counterparts in New York in September of 1950, and he just basically lays down the law to these people. And he says, you want American help? We're willing to send over a large land force as the backbone of a European defense organization, six divisions, serious force. Right? And we're willing to send over our most prestigious general from World War II, General Eisenhower, as the NATO commander. But what we want from you in return is that you'll agree to kind of move ahead with the rearmament of Western Germany. The Europeans are reluctant to do this. Why? Not because they don't understand the German troops needed in the long run. It's because they understand how dangerous the situation is, that the Soviets are kind of poised on the brink, that the Soviets might very well attack Europe. And if the Americans move ahead in terms of creating a new strong German army at this particular point, that's going to be viewed by the Soviets as deeply provocative, because there's no existing power framework in place that could serve to contain German power within the West. And so so the Europeans block it. They try and block it. They come up with schemes that call for all kinds of long negotiations to block this whole proposal. And they succeed in blocking it, to my mind, quite fortunately for the world, because it meant that the West didn't take the one action which, during its period of greatest weakness, which the Soviets would find most provocative, the building up of German power. So the Soviets pull back from the brink, right? And the West now has to kind of negotiate all of these issues relating to Germany's status, Germany's political rights, German military power, Germany's role in the Western community, and so on. These enormously complicated issues, and it's not until October 1954 that solutions are worked out. In other words, 4 years later. And by that time, the whole military balance has changed dramatically. So, and these 1954 arrangements, like I said, this provides us with another chance to see how a political system, which you might think should have served as the basis for a stable international order, how it came into being, how it could have worked, why it failed, because once again, it just failed. So that's what I'll be talking about next time. And like I said, the exams, for those of you who missed class on Friday, they'll be spread out here from the A's straight through to the Z's.